This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
From the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., backed by the trusted voices of Team Fox. A clear, fresh voice cutting through the noise to tell the truth. It's the Guy Benson Show with Guy Benson.
It's Wednesday, May 31st, 2023, last day of the month. Here on the Guy Benson Show on this Wednesday, thank you very much for joining us. Hump Day on the program here in D.C., heading up to New York tonight for a bunch of TV in the days to come. We'll tell you about that a bit later on. GuyBensonShow.com is our website here on the program. Same every day. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast is always free, always on demand. You can also follow us on social media at Guy Benson Show, Twitter and Instagram. You can follow me personally on those same platforms, at Guy P. Benson. Get a load of this lineup today. Nikki Haley, presidential candidate, will be here in the next hour. Yesterday, we welcomed Patrick McHenry, Republican of North Carolina, one of the lead McCarthy negotiators in the debt ceiling conversations. He made his case in favor of this deal that's going to be voted on today. They've got the rule vote first, and then tonight, assuming the rule vote goes through, tonight will be the final vote. And McHenry, who was one of the engineers of the agreement, obviously was in favor of it. There are dozens of Republicans who are against it, and I want to make sure that we are giving their side of this story as well. We have Congresswoman Nancy Mace. She is a no on the bill from South Carolina. She will be here on the show today. And then immediately after Congresswoman Mace, we have one of her colleagues on the red side of the aisle, Congressman David Joyce of Ohio, who's a yes. So we'll get a little back-to-back, almost a debate, point-counterpoint on the debt ceiling deal from two members of Congress. We also have Chip Roy, a very vocal opponent of this deal, lined up on the program tomorrow. Just a little note on that. And then in our final hour, Governor Chris Sununu of New Hampshire will be our guest. He is not just the governor up there, a very consequential presidential state. He has been, I would say, maybe sniffing around a little bit, kicking the tires to consider a presidential run himself. He's going to make a decision, he says, in the next couple of weeks. I want to maybe examine his thinking on that process a little bit. Very likable guy, very affable guy, extremely popular governor in New Hampshire. Does he have a path to the nomination? Is he seriously thinking about running, or is it just sort of a little bit of a flirtation? I just have a lot of questions for him. And then on some other topics as well. But in terms of presidential news, his entry would be news. There's breaking developments I saw today that former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, a friend of the program, he's planning to get in next week in New Hampshire, so he'll be running for president. And then Fox News just confirmed literally minutes ago that former Vice President Mike Pence is going to announce in Iowa next week. At least that's the plan. So the field is about to set, I would say. There might be a few stragglers, but a couple of these names are still out there. Sounds like Christie is in. Sounds like Pence is in addition to all the people who've already announced. And then Sununu, one of the remaining question marks, which is why I'm interested to ask him some questions here on the program. Of course, one of the other people who's already announced and has been in the race now for quite some time is Nikki Haley, which I mentioned at the top. She is one of our guests, in fact, our first guest, coming up right about 1 hour from now here on the Guy Benson Show. So that's just a lot to set the table for what is to come. What I want to start with, though, for the next couple of segments, is, in fact, the 2024 race, and a couple of interesting comments and dynamics and attacks and weird alliances that have come to the fore just in the last day or so. I wrote about this at townhall.com earlier in my capacity as political editor at Town Hall, and I write at the tip sheet every weekday. Kayleigh McEnany is one of our colleagues here at Fox News. Right, she joined Fox in 2021. She is now one of the co-hosts of Outnumbered, the noon Eastern show on Fox News Channel. I'll be joining on Monday on the couch, by the way. And I've gotten to get to know Kayleigh a little bit. I wouldn't call her someone that I'm very close with, but we have socialized briefly once or twice. We've exchanged a text message here or there. Of course, we've been on the air together in a few different capacities. I'm not sure she's been on this show, actually, come to think of it. Might be interesting to get her on at some point. But overall, I would say that Kayleigh McEnany is a very smart woman. She is always prepared. She is unfailingly, I would say, polite. And from what I understand, she's a very kind person as well. Right? That's my assessment of her, having seen her a little bit behind the scenes and worked with her. Again, we're not tight buddies or anything like that, but I know her a lot better than I used to, certainly, since we became colleagues. My first awareness of Kayleigh McEnany was back in 2015 and 2016 in particular, when she was one of the most visible surrogates and defenders of Donald Trump when he was running for president in that cycle. And to be perfectly frank, I was not a big fan of hers because I was not in favor of Trump. I did not want Trump to be the Republican nominee. I've always been very open about that. Whether you like that or not, whether you agree or disagree, that was my position, and I didn't try to hide the ball. Right? I want to manipulate people. I just want to say, here's who I am, this is what I believe, and here are the reasons why. And my hope is that more people respect that than don't. Right? That's just my philosophy, my approach to this gig, to this job. If I'm not telling you the truth with transparency, what is the point of me? Right? That's kind of how I come at this. And so because Kayleigh was such a prominent, dogged defender of Trump on everything, right? He would say something really inflammatory or wrong, and she would show up day in and day out on CNN, as she, I believe, got hired over there for a while. She was one of the most visible, prominent people defending him in very hostile territory constantly. And even when I felt like she had to contort herself into intellectual pretzels, which I'm sure now knowing her was frustrating at times for her because she's a smart person, right? I believe she has a Harvard Law degree. I mean, she's very intelligent. And for her to have to come on the air knowing that it's going to be a barrage at CNN, right? They have these 17-person panels, and everyone hates Trump except for her, and they want to destroy her and the person that she's rooting for and eventually would come to work for. I mean, she was a target. She was a marked woman on the air every day, where there was contempt and disdain for what she was saying on set and at home, a lot of that audience. Like, she was a designated villain. But she would show up faithfully and engage in the fight to the best of her ability. And I thought sometimes it was just, you know, too much. There's only so much spin you can engage in. I was like, Kayleigh, come on. But I had sort of this grudging respect for her as well, because she was, especially compared to some of her counterparts in that space, effective. She was ready. Like, she knew what was coming her way. She understood what her opponents were going to say, and she had thought it through. So she would come back at them just time and time again, often to their consternation and frustration. And to know that everyone disagrees with you, and some of it is visceral, and you are going to be effectively, or at least they're going to try to make you a pinata every day in a place like that, and to show up and do it anyway, time and time again, having to have as much homework on your hands as possible. I mean, that is not easy. And she did it. And you can say it was her finest hour, it was not her finest hour, but that is what she did. And she developed a bit of a following. Obviously, she caught the attention of Trump and his campaign, and ultimately, a couple years later, of course, he was elected president, to the shock and horror of a lot of folks at CNN and elsewhere. And he had gone through a couple press secretaries. Sarah Huckabee Sanders stepped away. She was getting ready to lay the foundation for a candidacy for governor down in her state, which, of course, she won. She is now the governor of Arkansas. And for the last almost year of the Trump presidency, he needed a press secretary, and he tapped Kayleigh McEnany. And I would watch some of those briefings. For a long time, they wouldn't brief. Because I think there was one other press secretary in between there who never briefed. There might have been four total press secretaries. It was kind of a blur, wasn't it? But the briefings went away for a while under that third press secretary, if memory serves, whose name is just gone. It'll come to me. But Kayleigh took her place at that podium and started to revive the briefings. And she would use those briefings to do combat with these reporters. And she would anticipate their questions and their attacks and their criticisms and their little speeches and sermons from guys like Jim Acosta. And she, very much on brand, had a book of information, a lot of it committed to memory, every day. And whether you liked Trump and agreed with Trump or not, she was going to rumble with these people, and she was going to be very smart about it. She had some pretty sharp elbows when she needed to, but always, as I said, very politely. And she would sometimes, like, bring receipts, right? She would have headlines. She would have video clips. They would use the audiovisual capacity in the briefing room to really go after these reporters and their news outlets and the Democrats. I mean, she really was tough and developed an even bigger fan base, especially in sort of the MAGA Republican universe. People really liked Kayleigh McEnany and the way that she did her job. So when she left the White House and the administration ended, when Trump lost to Biden, she joined Team Fox, and that is now how I've gotten to know her. Why do I mention all of this about Kayleigh McEnany? Why am I opening the show with, you know, 10 straight minutes talking about one of my colleagues? Well, apparently, yesterday on the air, Kayleigh was talking about a poll, I think it was a Morning Consult poll, that showed, yet again, as do most of the polls, Trump up big in the Republican primary. And I think she was just sort of spitballing. She didn't have the exact number in front of her, but she said that Trump was up 25 points. And in fact, that particular poll apparently had him up 34 points, not 25. So Donald Trump, I guess this got back to him, or he saw this, and so he posted on Truth Social about Kayleigh McEnany, who was one of his most vociferous and earliest defenders in some of the toughest media settings you can think of for a Trump supporter at CNN, and then an absolutely loyal fighter as press secretary every day for him for the better part of a year. But she got the size of the polling lead for Trump wrong in an offhanded remark, I believe, on Fox, and Trump on Truth, quote-unquote, said this: Kayleigh Milquetoast McEnany, and he misspelled Milquetoast, just gave out the wrong poll numbers on Fox News. I am 34 points up on DeSanctimonious, not 25 up. While 25 is great, it's not 34. She knew the number was corrected upwards by the group that did the poll. The rhinos and globalists can have her. Fox News should only use real stars. So, under the bus goes another former top advisor, colleague, spokesperson, cabinet member to this man. And look, this isn't about one polling number that she said incorrectly, according to Trump on the air. It's about more than that. Kayleigh is very enthusiastic in defending the record of the Trump administration. She says positive things about Trump all the time on our air. She also, as a Floridian, really likes Ron DeSantis and the governor job that he's done leading that state. Right, so she's an admirer of DeSantis. She likes him. She says positive things about him as well, in addition to the positive things she says about Trump and the Trump record. It's not like she's come out and endorsed Ron DeSantis for president. She just isn't all in for Trump and is unwilling to parrot the attacks on DeSantis because she likes DeSantis. Right, so she is positive. She has good things to say about both of these guys and is staying effectively neutral, to my knowledge, in the primary so far. But because she is not endorsing Trump and ripping DeSantis, obviously Trump's one-sided sense, twisted, one-way street of loyalty, that has now been breached. He's mad, and so he's done with her. She's dead to him. The rhinos and the globalists can have her. Fox News should only use real stars. And I think for a lot of people who like Kayleigh and feel like she did a great job as press secretary and was a very effective member of that administration, I mean, here's just another example of Trump disposing of someone just in a tantrum because he feels like whatever his impossible, ever-moving target of what loyalty constitutes to him, which again is only owed to him, it doesn't go the other way ever. If you violated that in some way, then he's mad and it's over. And so that's the way that has his big kiss off, apparently, to Kayleigh Milquetoast McEnany, which I think is very much in line with his character and the way that he does business. I think it also has implications for Republican voters. Whether you like Kayleigh or not, whether you're offended by this or not, and I will make that point as soon as we come back on The Guy Benson Show. Stay tuned.
Not the same talking points here. The Guy Benson Show.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
I'm Guy Benson. We're back. By the way, the trivia question answer was Stephanie Grisham, the third often overlooked Trump press secretary. Spicer, Sanders, Grisham, and then Kayleigh McEnany, who Donald Trump attacked on Truth Social yesterday, calling her milquetoast and saying that the global rhinos can have her and she's not a star, I guess because she is not sufficiently effusive in her praise for Trump all of the time and she says too many nice things about Ron DeSantis. So that's it. Relationship is now strained or over, Trump has decided. And you just go through. I mean, look at the cabinet of Donald Trump and the number of cabinet secretaries that he has trashed publicly or is feuding with publicly. His own vice president, of course, Mike Pence, who's about to get into the presidential race. Everything that happened there, that relationship totally dissolved because Pence wouldn't violate the Constitution after the ticket lost. I mean, the list goes on. People who used to work for Trump in various capacities, who he attacks publicly. It is a long, growing roster. It's exhausting. I guess some people probably love every second of the drama. I'd imagine there are probably even some hardcore Trump loyalists who get weary of it. Imagine how the election-determining independent and swing voters, feel about this type of thing. Like, Kayleigh McEnany? Really? The Guy Benson Show is back right after this break.
same issues, but with a fresh perspective.
The Guy Benson Show.
We are back here on The Guy Benson Show. Thank you for listening. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast is always free. And are we going to talk more about 2024 right now? Yes, we are. Yep, we're going to do that because the campaign's heating up. We talked about the Kayleigh McEnany attack from Trump. Really unprovoked. Oh, he only punches back. She did not punch at him at all. This is an unprovoked attack out of spite because he's annoyed that she says nice things about DeSantis. It's obvious. And to see some of that sort of hive mind in MAGA world, very online on Twitter, being like, all of a sudden, yep, the talking point is out. We're now against Kayleigh McEnany. Yeah, she's now a never-Trumper or like hater or whatever. Like, how disloyal of her to stab him in the back. He called her when she had cancer. He gave her an opportunity. Like, it's crazy. She worked her ass off for him. She was on CNN day in and day out getting bludgeoned by everyone around her and standing her ground for him. And this is the reward ultimately that she gets. So, I mean, it's like, I don't even know her that well. I'm not super offended for her. I'm just saying constantly the drama and the backbiting and the sort of snarling and the purges. There's a number of people who I guess like live for this stuff and relish it. I would submit to you that a lot of people on the Republican side and then those key people who decide elections, this is the type of stuff that drives them crazy about Trump, even when they like Trump's policies more than the garbage that we have right now with Joe Biden. This is the type of stuff that ultimately make people not vote for him or show up and vote for the other guy. You might think I'm wrong about that. I think deep down, even a lot of Trump supporters agree with me. Like, if he could just impose a little bit of discipline and do more productive, like, the guy hasn't held a campaign rally forever. He's had one rally this year. It's almost June. He occasionally puts stuff up on Truth Social. He occasionally shows up for an interview somewhere. That's it. I know they talk about how, DeSantis, he's just Bush Light. Karl Rove is running his campaign. I mean, that's a lie, completely untrue. That there's just no hint of truth to it at all, as DeSantis said on the record, as Rove said on the record here on this show. What has actually happened is the Trump team has actually hired on a bunch of Bush people. And my guess is the Bush people are saying, let's just let him be the front runner, keep him out of sight, out of mind, actually, to a large extent. The last time he was very much in the public eye was for the indictment, which a lot of us thought was totally political and indefensible. So we defended him over Alvin Bragg. That's a no-brainer for me. And he raced way up in the polls, and they're saying, you know, why really work too hard? Why put him out there when he's got a majority of the Republican support right now? So I guess to fill his days at his golf club down in Florida, he has to figure out the next thing that he's angry about, the next feud to start or try to settle, and the latest victim, the latest target, it's Kayleigh McEnany. And this is like, this will never stop. This is who he is. This is what he does. If you like that and think this is good and that she deserves it and she had it coming, that disloyal Kayleigh McEnany, and this is the way to go and beat the Democrats and win the next election, by all means, like all aboard the Trump train. If that is your approach to politics and you think that's successful and that's the brand of politics that people like, especially independents, and people who may have voted for Trump in 2016 and then flipped to the Democrats for the next three elections. I mean, then you and I will have a disagreement. It's okay to disagree. Here's another disagreement that we might have. I think it is not only crazy and wrong, but dangerous to say over and over again, as Trump has, that the state of New York and Andrew Cuomo did a better job handling COVID than Florida and Ron DeSantis. Let's just say you don't like DeSantis. Let's just say you are a supporter of someone else for president, even Trump. you're a Trump guy, you're out there for Nikki, you like Tim Scott, whatever it is, you're not a DeSantis person. If you are center-right, I'm willing to bet that none of you actually believe that Florida handled COVID worse than New York. That is not true. By no metric is that true. Trump says, well, Florida had the third highest deaths. That's because Florida has the third highest population. We've been through this. It's just like raw vote numbers. It's meaningless. Per capita, age adjusted, Florida's better than New York. Excess deaths. And then, I mean, you look at economic metrics. You look at learning loss, school openings, basically everything. Mandates. You go down the list. New York is vastly inferior to Florida. And the results speak for themselves in terms of people leaving one place and moving to the other. Right? The population gap, which was already growing, got even bigger. People chose Florida, and the data backs it up. But Trump just keeps saying over and over. So we played this clip on the show last week. This is not like a one-off. This is a full-blown, official Donald Trump for president talking point from the man himself that Florida was worse than New York on COVID and that Cuomo was better than DeSantis. Cut 27 as a reminder.
How about the fact that he had the third most deaths of any state having to do with the China virus or COVID? Even Cuomo did better. He was number four. He shut down everything, including the beaches.
So, I mean, we have rebutted and debunked a number of the things that Trump says about Florida and DeSantis multiple times, and part of me doesn't want to waste my breath constantly going back to it. The beaches thing is made up. There were a handful of counties that were allowed to close the beaches for a short while. That ended, and DeSantis figured out the data very early and lowered the boom and completely went the opposite direction of Fauciism on almost every possible front. If Trump wants to try to argue that Florida was a big lockdown state and DeSantis was a big lockdown guy, there was a man who dressed up as the Grim Reaper. They put him on CNN constantly. He would go around with his, you know, dark cloak and sickle on Florida beaches to try to shame those people and to shame Ron DeSantis for all the death he was causing. Ron DeSantis, because the beaches were open, and Trump's like, oh, he shut down all the beaches. He was a shutdown guy. Cuomo was better. This is what Trump keeps saying. And part of the reason that it bothers me so much is not because, like, oh, I have to defend Ron DeSantis. He's perfectly capable of doing that himself. In fact, we've got clips of him doing that I might get time to play here in a moment. What bothers me about it is this was one of the most important periods of time for American and world leadership in my life, where policy mattered a lot. And you had some people following the actual data and common sense and the Constitution and people's individual liberties, and other people were happy to trample on all of that for an agenda. And Florida, more than almost any other place in the world, certainly in the country, got it overwhelmingly correct, while New York did not. And California and Illinois, and you go down the list. And for Trump, purely for political reasons, like, we all understand what's happening here. He's trying to just hit DeSantis with everything he possibly can from every direction. He doesn't believe half of it. He's just saying it. To pick this one in particular, to say that Florida is an awful place, misery and despair and all the stuff that they said about Florida, and to say that Cuomo in New York was better than Florida on COVID, that's not just an attack on one politician for political reasons. That is an attack on the philosophy of governance that made Florida a beacon of freedom in a very dark and consequential time. It's an attack on conservative governance. There are things you can criticize about DeSantis and how he's been governor. I have a few myself. This is not one of them. This is nowhere near the list. When Trump and Fauci and others were shaming people like Kemp and DeSantis, they were charting their own course. Then you look at the law and order that they have in the state of Florida. You look at the incredible economy that's humming along in Florida, the people moving to that state, the things that they've accomplished in terms of conservative reforms on education and all of it, the schools being open. That is a massive success story of conservative governance where the Republican Party, a conservative Republican Party, won a landslide election in a year where the Republicans didn't do so well elsewhere. Cough, Trump, cough. As a little gratuitous aside, Florida did it. Florida was a shining example of what we as conservatives should be willing to celebrate overwhelmingly. If you have nitpicks and issues, fine. But overall, the results are glittering. So when Trump attacks that for political reasons to go after DeSantis, he's actually going after something much bigger than just DeSantis, and that really bothers me. And if he's attacking DeSantis for too many deaths in Florida, say, oh, Cuomo had less. Cuomo in New York had fewer deaths. And I'll remind you, Andrew Cuomo is the guy who forced sick senior citizens into nursing homes, and then COVID spread like fire among those communities, highly vulnerable communities, resulting in a bunch of needless deaths. They covered it up. They lied about it. They cooked the books. They undercounted COVID deaths in New York. Everything that the media and the left was criticizing and alleging DeSantis was doing, Cuomo actually did those things. Then they put him at Biden's convention. He talked about how great he was, how great New York was. That was the left-wing media narrative. Cuomo good, New York good, DeSantis Florida bad, evil. The exact opposite was the truth when it comes to COVID policies and outcomes. And Donald Trump, the Republican frontrunner for president, is taking the pro-Cuomo, pro-New York lie and embracing it for fleeting gain to score some points and try to draw some political blood against someone that he's mad is running against him. Again, that's more than just DeSantis. That's the Florida model. That's just the overall approach to COVID that was correct. Trump is on Cuomo's side on this. And it makes you wonder, and other people are now asking this, if the argument from Trump is DeSantis is worse than Cuomo because of the deaths, how do you read that critique other than Trump believes that DeSantis should have shut down harder and locked down harder and imposed more mandates? If he's saying that it was better in New York than Florida, which he says over and over again, he put it on Truth Social again yesterday. If that's what you're saying, look at all the more deaths in Florida. Just totally ignoring the per capita stuff because he's just trying to make a point with a blunt object. Then you would have to, at least on some level, defend the Cuomo approach, which is indefensible. And yet that's the club that Trump has picked up off the ground to try to hit DeSantis over the head with it. And I just wonder, is there a single person right of center who actually believes that that's true? Trump deferred way too much to Dr. Fauci for far too long. And the question is, if he were president again and something were to happen again, his argument right now seems to be DeSantis' problem was he didn't lock down enough in Florida. Does anyone on the right actually agree with that? Someone who is threatened by this is none other than Andrew Cuomo, the disgraced, impeached, resigned governor of New York, a Democrat. He tweeted yesterday evening, "Donald Trump tells the truth. Finally, New York got hit first and worst, but New Yorkers acted responsibly. Florida's policy of denial allowed COVID to spread, and that's why they had a very large second wave." No, it's not. The virus is going to virus. The lockdowns and all of these mandates didn't work. The masking didn't work. None of this stuff worked. The vaccines saved lives, especially for vulnerable people. They did not prevent transmission the way that they told us it would. The vaccines and Operation Warp Speed, big feather in the cap of Donald Trump. He seems to agree. I give him credit for that. I know a lot of people on the right disagree. I give him credit for that. But when it comes to a lot of these other policies, they did not work. Florida had better outcomes in every conceivable way than New York with COVID. And Donald Trump is out there saying that's not true. Team Cuomo on this one, team lockdown on this one, and Andrew Cuomo like crawls out of whatever hole he's living in these days to be like, thank you, Donald Trump, for telling the truth. Donald Trump tells the truth. That's a direct quote from Andrew Cuomo. We spent a lot of time talking about him and breaking down his lies, specifically with facts. And now it's like, it's like you're through the looking glass. Now you've got Donald Trump with this strange alliance with Andrew Cuomo agreeing together that Ron DeSantis was terrible on COVID. What? Like, is this what Republican conservative voters want? Is this what they believe? And if not, like, why does Trump keep saying this stuff? I have one more point on this that I'll make as soon as we come back. Then we'll move on to other topics, I promise. There's a lot to get to here today on The Guy Benson Show. Stepping aside, coming right back. Stay with us.
Always fresh, always fair. The Guy Benson Show.
So I don't think anybody buys this idea that Cuomo in New York did it better. We're the fastest growing state. If you say Cuomo did a better job with COVID than Florida did, first of all, that's not what he used to say. This is like new. Like 6 months ago, he would have never said that, right? He used to say how great Florida was. Hell, his whole family moved to Florida under my governorship. Are you kidding me? So some of this stuff, I think, is, look, if someone is saying that, I am gonna counterpunch. I'm going to fight back on it.
Back on the Guy Benson Show, that was Ron DeSantis himself replying to Donald Trump, pointing out that basically the whole Trump family moved to Florida, the hellacious, terrible place filled with misery and despair, where New York was better on COVID. Just totally, totally untrue. And I wrote about this today at townhall.com. I cited a Wall Street Journal piece about a study that ranked the states looking at mortality, but also education and the economy. Florida was best performing of the big states. New York was 49th in the country. Almost dead last. So he's responding, as you just heard, DeSantis is. Our friend Molly Hemingway thinks he shouldn't. She tweeted yesterday, this campaign strategy, the response from DeSantis, seems like a great way to win Twitter, but a less great way to win the primary. Seems to me he should attack the McConnell wing of the party at least 100 times as much as the Trump wing. I mean, setting aside whatever the McConnell stuff is, this is a 95-5 issue. Trump is dead wrong in multiple ways. This is an opening. It would be malpractice for DeSantis not to fire back the way that he's firing back, in my view, and that's what he's doing. All right, another hour coming up. Nikki Haley next.
A new generation of conservative talk. Right here, right now. Fair, fun, and backed by the trusted voices and reporting resources of Fox News. Fox News. You're listening to The Guy Benson Show. And now, here's your host, Guy Benson.
It's a brand new hour here on The Guy Benson Show. Thank you for listening. GuyBensonShow.com is our website. The podcast is always free every day at Guy Benson Show Twitter and Instagram. As we begin our middle hour, Fox News alert. The Dow is down 134 points at the close, finishing up at 32,908, so dipping below 33,000. Meanwhile, another Fox News alert. We're watching this. There is a vote going on the House floor right now. This is on the rule, a little bit technical here, a rule on the bill on the debt ceiling deal to then get to a debate and a vote tonight on the actual bill itself. Right now, the yeas are lagging the nays a little bit. It seems like the Democrats might be holding out to see how many votes they'll need to provide in order for this thing to pass. Right now, all of the yes votes to get onto this bill are coming from Republicans. A majority of the majority has supported this. A little less right now than 24 Republicans have voted no. So it will probably come down to the wire and a little bit of gamesmanship here where the Democratic leaders will have to play their card at some point. It's expected to pass. You never know. But it's expected to pass, which would trigger then hours of debate and teeing up potentially, as if this all plays out as anticipated, a vote later this evening on the debt ceiling bill. So that is happening right now here in Washington, D.C. Just an update for you there. With that, let's bring in our first guest of today's show. It's Nikki Haley. She's the former governor of South Carolina, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and now a presidential candidate for the Republican nomination in 2024. And it is great to have you back here.
Thanks so much, Guy. Thanks for having me.
You bet. So let's just start with this news of the day, since this is a very D.C. thing that's happening, but it has wider implications for the economy and all of that. As you watch the debt ceiling fight play out in Washington, what is your reaction? And if you were president, how would you have handled this situation?
I mean, it's a bipartisan national disgrace. I mean, you know, it's easy to blame Biden, but we need to speak truth here. Our Republicans did this to us, too. You know, this all started, you go back to that $2.2 trillion COVID stimulus bill that basically expanded welfare that now leaves us with 90 million Americans on Medicaid, 42 million Americans on food stamps. And if that wasn't enough, Republicans doubled down and opened up earmarks for the first time in 10 years. You know, pushing through 7,000 of them in December, 7.5 million on horse racing in Arizona, 30 million on Honors College in Vermont, 10 million on a courthouse in Colorado. And so now we get to this situation where they're talking about the debt ceiling. And here you go again. They basically take off from after a post-COVID like flush of money and don't even take that into account. I mean, they're focusing on increasing the debt by another $4 trillion over the next 2 years. It doesn't actually cut spending after all of this pandemic spending that we've had. It just kicks the can down the road. And that's why you see all the major conservative groups oppose it. It's a serious problem that we have with Congress. They can't say that Republicans and Democrats don't agree on anything because they love to waste taxpayer dollars. And they're showing that once again.
What do you think Speaker McCarthy should have done differently in this particular fight? I mean, I think broadly speaking, a lot of things need to change in Congress and in D.C. And the fact that they took some of the biggest drivers of debt, the biggest drivers of the debt, off the table entirely on a bipartisan basis. I mean, I get why they did that for political reasons, but for actual fiscal reasons, it is just maddening to me. Within this context, the Democrats holding the Senate, Joe Biden in the White House, do you think McCarthy could have driven a better bargain here, a tougher bargain here?
I mean, look, a House majority means something. I mean, it means that we actually have the ability to push where things go. And I think we needed two things. We needed a plan to cut spending, and we needed a plan on how we're going to start to pay down the debt. And we didn't get that. All this did was literally kick the can down the road for somebody else to deal with at another time. And we need to be honest with the American people. We need to go and say this flush of cash that happened during the pandemic was dangerous. It was not good. We saw that. We need to start dealing with it. I mean, you go back, and I've said, look back at 2018. They did this at that time. They went and they passed through all of this increased spending, and it wasn't helpful. And you look at that and you say, you know, they supported raising the debt by trillions of dollars 5 years ago, and look at where we are now. Now they're going to turn around and do it again with $4 more trillion. And I can tell you, our kids are never going to forgive us for this.
Nikki Haley, you announced your presidential campaign in mid-February. We are now almost in June. You've been campaigning hard. You've been in your home state of South Carolina. I've seen you all over the place, Iowa, New Hampshire, all of those early states, obviously. As you're out there on the trail, what are some of the biggest themes that you are hearing from voters? And what impact has that had, those messages? What have they had on this campaign that you're running?
I think that, you know, the biggest message that I hear across the three states is just the economy, the inflation, the spending, and the debt. I mean, people really feel that. They feel it going to the grocery store. They feel it, you know, whether they're going into credit card debt, they get the fact that this is not going anywhere anytime soon. And so that's a big thing. The second thing I hear about is transparency in the classroom. Parents are very worried that they don't know what's being said to their kids. They don't know what's being taught to their kids, and they deserve to know. And then immigration, illegal immigration. I mean, what's happening on the border has really upset a lot of people because now every state's a border state. And they feel it, whether it's the fentanyl that's coming, you know, into their states, or whether it's just the fact that all of these illegal immigrants have crossed over, and that's a further burden on our economy.
I want to talk about this actually coming up a little bit later on the show. I have a couple thoughts. We've got the sound bites. But just boiling it down, we have not really seen any campaigning at all from the sitting president. He announced that he's running again. He wants another 4 years. They put out a video. That's it. I mean, no events. They're not telling us about the numbers that they're getting in terms of small donors online, anything like that. What do you make of that? Are you surprised to see virtually nothing at all from the reelection campaign of this president?
I'm not surprised at all. I mean, this is a man who won by campaigning in his basement. And so now he's going to release a video. We're not going to see much. And this is why I will continue to say a vote for Biden is truly a vote for President Harris. We have to understand that if Biden wins, it is really President Kamala Harris that we're looking at. And America needs to wake up. We have a country to save. We've got to make sure we get on the right track. We need a new generational leader. We need someone that's going to deal with these new issues with new solutions. And we've got to get us back on track. Americans are tired. They're just tired. They're tired of the spending. They're tired of the rhetoric. They're tired of the negativity. They're tired of, you know, all of this political correctness. They're just tired. They want to get back to an America that's strong and proud and normal again. And I think we have to do that. We can't stop and just allow this to happen to our kids. We have to go and take this and really be a part of the solution.
As I mentioned in your intro, you were the ambassador to the United Nations on behalf of the United States during the Trump administration. You dealt with foreign policy a lot in that body. And obviously, we've all been watching now for well over a year, this war in Ukraine. There was a drone attack in Moscow, escalating tensions again. There's been just brutal bombing of Kyiv in recent days. And I know a lot of Americans have sort of stopped paying very close attention to that conflict, but it still has huge geopolitical implications. So just putting on that hat in foreign policy, as you watch that conflict and the status quo right now that we're witnessing, what do you think Americans need to know? How should we be thinking about this in your mind? And if you were commander in chief, what would you be doing differently than the Biden administration?
Well, first of all, we wouldn't have allowed it to happen in the first place. Let's not forget that Russia surrounded Ukraine almost a year before they went in and actually invaded. That could have been prevented. That could have been stopped, and nothing was done. So, you know, if you take it from that premise, and then you look at the fact this is actually bigger than just a war about Ukraine. This is a war on freedom, and it's one we have to win. Russia went and invaded a freedom-loving democracy. And we need to believe tyrants when they say they're going to do something. China said they were going to take Hong Kong. They did. Russia said they were going to invade Ukraine. We watched them. China said Taiwan is next. We better believe them. Russia said Poland and the Baltics are after Ukraine. I mean, if we're not careful, that will happen. And then we're looking at a world war. We need to prevent war. And the best way to do that is not giving cash to Ukraine, not putting troops on the ground, but working with our allies to make sure they have the equipment and the ammunition to win. What we know now is a win for Russia is a win for China. That's why China is paying so much attention to this. We need to make sure Ukraine finishes the deal. And we know they're doing that. Russia's hit rock bottom. We know that because they're getting drones from Iran and missiles from North Korea. They've raised the draft age to 65. A couple of weeks ago, they were handing Russians off the streets shovels to fight with. So he knows he's in a corner. And let's keep in mind that this is, as much as Russia's whining and complaining about the drone strikes that happen, you know, it can't be that Russia can savage every Ukrainian city and town day after day for months and then suddenly cry escalation when there's one drone
right
that strikes Moscow. I mean, Russia's reaping what it's sown. It's never a threat to Russia. And if Russia leaves Ukraine, it would have nothing to worry about from any Ukrainian attacks. So
Nikki Haley, we got to leave it there. I hate to cut you off, but we're up on a hard break. Presidential candidate Nikki Haley, our guest here on The Guy Benson Show. We so appreciate your time. We look forward to next time on The Guy Benson Show, and we'll be right back. I'm Guy Benson. We are back. Just bringing you a Fox News alert as the news is now breaking here. Looking at the House floor, we were telling you about this rule vote, which sounds very arcane and technical, which it is, but it's an essential part of this step. Whether you like the debt bill, like the debt ceiling agreement, or you kind of begrudgingly shrug your shoulders about it, which is kind of where I am, or you hate it, in order for there to be a debate and a vote on the legislation, the rule has to pass on the floor. That then triggers the next stage, which is debate and final vote. And we were watching very carefully as Republicans were lining up overwhelmingly to vote yes on the rule, but close to 30 Republicans, right now it's 29 Republicans, were voting no. So without Democratic votes, there was no way the rule was going to pass. This was not going to be a Republican-only proposition, which is not surprising. This is what was sort of anticipated, but what the Democrats were doing was withholding any yes votes at all. Maybe to try to make the Republicans sweat to see how many votes would be needed in order to have this thing pass, the rule pass, and get to the final vote itself. What McCarthy was trying to do, and again, I'm not passing judgment on the substance at this point. I've talked about that. We'll have actually a good debate coming up here in the next few segments with a member of the Republican conference who's against the bill and a member who's for it. We'll have one segment and then another. You'll get both vantage points on it. And we had one of the lead negotiators here yesterday. But just from a logistical standpoint, what McCarthy was hoping to get was a clear majority of his members. So a majority of the majority. So there was a bare minimum number that was needed in the low 100s. And right now he's got 188 yeses and 29 noes. And there's a handful of stragglers who haven't voted. But, you know, that is a very clear, overwhelming, strong majority of House Republicans have voted in favor of the debt ceiling agreement between McCarthy and Biden. And I'm sure there are some of you who are angry and you're on the side of the 29 who voted no. But just in terms of where the caucus is, this is another victory for Kevin McCarthy. And just politically speaking, you might think in the scheme of things, it's not a victory for the country. Separate question. In terms of legislation and actually threading needles, this is another win for McCarthy, assuming that the bill then passes tonight, which I think it's very clear that it will. But the Democrats, for quite some time over the course of this vote that's been playing out for more than half an hour now, or roughly half an hour, all of the Democrat votes were no. Like right now, you've got 29 Republicans against the rule and 169 Democrats against the rule, voting no on this thing. They were going to need some Democrats to vote yes in order for a majority to advance this process to debate and then an up or down on passage. And so the Republicans were approaching 190. You saw the no votes approaching 30. And then you had some of the more moderate Democrats go to the leader on the floor, Hakeem Jeffries, and all at once, basically, they said, okay, the time has come. We know how many votes are needed. And then all of the yes votes from Democrats just came cascading in roughly at the same time. So I could see some of the people following all of this on Twitter saying, oh, the no's are winning. And if the yeses failed, if the no's prevailed, the nays, right? If the nays prevailed on the rule, then the bill's dead. They'd have to start over again. And then who knows what the markets would do tomorrow, and all of this stuff would be a huge black eye for McCarthy, and it'd be pretty chaotic. And yes, for quite a period of time, it was very, very close back and forth, and there was an edge for the no's. In fact, they had a double-digit edge on votes for the no's. And what I kept saying was, off the air, I was saying what I think is going to happen is the Democrat yeses are going to come in at the very last minute. And now we're up to 46 yeses on the Democratic side. In fact, some of the no's from Dems are flipping to yes. So right now the vote is 235 to 192. This thing has passed. There's a handful of votes that haven't come in yet, like four on each side. It's not going to change the outcome here. So you have a majority of Republicans, and it's sort of hard to explain this. I'm looking at the graphics on C-SPAN. You've got a majority of Republicans voting yes on the deal, or at least on the rule, which is sort of like a preliminary vote to get to the deal. 189 to 29. That's among Republicans only. 189 yes, 29 no, as it stands right now. A few more votes coming in. On the Democratic side, it's lopsided in the other direction, but you've got 50 Democrats, now 51, another one just came in, voting yes, and 159 voting no. So I think what the Democrats wanted to do was see what the Republicans could achieve on their own, how many votes they could marshal, and then maybe have them sweat it out a tiny bit. And then they were like, okay, green light, if you want to vote yes on this thing, go ahead. Because it's not just McCarthy's deal, it's also Biden's deal. So if this thing, you know, crashes and burns, if that had happened, that would have been embarrassing for Biden as well. So it seemed highly improbable to me that that would be allowed to happen. And now it hasn't. It's passed. 241, 187, the final numbers might change a tiny bit, but the rule has passed. And now the debate begins for final passage, which would be tonight. We have two members from the Republican side, one against, one in favor, and we will get to both of them in the next few segments. So you want to hear that discussion on The Guy Benson Show, which is straight ahead.
Miss a minute, miss a lot. The Guy Benson Show.
Halfway through The Guy Benson Show. Halfway through the week. Thank you for listening. GuyBensonShow.com, podcast always free. As promised, we wanted to talk to lawmakers on the Republican side of the aisle, but on different sides of the debt ceiling deal debate. And we begin that debate with Congresswoman Nancy Mace, Republican of South Carolina. And Congresswoman, it is great to have you back here.
Thank you so much, Guy, for having me back on.
All right, so I saw your tweet the other day. Washington is broken. Republicans got outsmarted by a president who can't find his pants. I'm voting no on the debt ceiling debacle because playing the D.C. game isn't worth selling out our kids and grandkids. Okay, that's your headline-grabbing tweet about why you were voting no. But on substance, let's delve into it. What most offended you about this deal to the point that you can't lend your vote to it?
Where do I start? Can I have more than one answer? Because there's more than one thing. Let's start with there actually is no limit to the debt ceiling in this bill. There is no cap. And quite frankly, voting on a clean debt ceiling would have been better than the bill that we're going to be voting on tonight, number one. The second thing is we were setting into law historically high levels of spending. COVID levels of spending. This COVID spending was supposed to just be for an emergency, and we weren't supposed to maintain it. Well, we are putting into law, you know, roughly $6 trillion, more or less, spending as baseline spending going forward in the future. And, you know, those two things alone, it's, you know, not to mention the fact that we're funding every single progressive line item spending program that progressives want, the president wants, we're funding all of it. And there are other, you know, provisions within the bill that water it down and don't make it worth the paper it's printed on. But that's just where we start.
Yeah, I mean, I know one of these reforms that they're talking about when it comes to, I think it was regulations, there's an element of the bill that says that the Biden administration can simply waive it if they feel like they need to. And I mean, that's no teeth at all to something like that. And they shouldn't be touting that as some sort of giant win. I was a little surprised just there to hear you, Congresswoman, say that you think a clean debt ceiling hike with no strings attached, which is what Joe Biden wanted, what the Democrats wanted, you think that would be better than this?
quite frankly, absolutely. When you look at how we're normalizing, well, because the record high spending we're putting into law, our baseline going forward is $6 trillion. There's literally no ceiling to the debt limit. And it's just, you just can't do this. And you're allowing one person, the director of OMB, to wave around the caps. They have the authority, singular sole authority, one person to go around the caps and spend for any program to advance the progressive Biden agenda. And that's what that was verbatim quote from the director of OMB yesterday. Why? They're literally, the left is telling us they're going to steamroll us. Why are we allowing them to do that? And if, you know, I'm disappointed that we weren't able to make a few small minor changes to this bill. Like if we could have taken out that provision that would allow the Biden administration to waive any of the spending caps for any program that they wanted to, and that really null and voids the whole purpose of the bill to do that. The other thing that we
could have
done.
It's only some of them. All of them. It's only specific elements that they could waive, which I think if you can waive it, then there's no point in putting it in, right? That's just like ink on a paper. It means nothing. Some of the caps are actually, at least for a few years, much stronger and enforceable. So I'm just jumping in for the point of clarity.
This is a deficit cut of $2.1 trillion. Actually, it's not. This bill only goes – it's only statutory for 2 years. You have to pray that Republicans still control the House after 2 years from now for any of this, and just hope and pray on a handshake that Congress is going to do what it promises it's going to do.
Right,
and
stick to it, which they don't in the past.
Yeah, well, years 3 to 10, there's nothing in here that binds us to saying these are the caps from years 3 to 10. Nothing. And so to say that it's going to cut $2 trillion to the deficit over 10 years, it's not going to do that. CBO says it's not going to do that. And, you know, when you're looking at insolvency of entitlement programs 10 years from now, this is untenable. And the vast majority of Americans want us to cut spending. That doesn't matter if you're R, D, or I, Republican, Democrat, or Independent. Everybody wants us to cut spending in order to increase the debt ceiling. This bill doesn't do that. It's more of a shell game than anything else, and I can't support it.
Yeah, I mean, fair enough. I think that there are a few incremental wins that are small ball. It's nothing to write home about. Better in my mind than a clean debt ceiling increase, because all of the problems that you just mentioned would still be the case, but they would be even a little bit worse. That's at least how I kind of look at it. But every argument that's being made and marshaled by folks like you and Chip Roy and others, on the substance, I agree with basically all of those arguments. I also recognize there's only so much leverage that Republicans have with a tiny majority in one house of Congress, and of course not controlling the White House either. When you see someone like Jim Jordan or Thomas Massie, who are not considered to be, you know, sort of flakes or moderates or anything like that, when they're saying there are serious conservative wins in this bill, which is why they're supporting it, I mean, do you think that they're just dead wrong? Are they missing something? Are they bad conservatives for this? Or is this just sort of a prudential judgment call?
I disagree in principle with that sentiment. But I'll also say that if you're a chairman of a committee up here, you really aren't allowed to vote against leadership. I mean, if you want to keep your committee chairmanship, that's how this place works. And if you don't want to go along with leadership, then you don't get to be committee chairman. That's just how D.C. works. It's how it works on both sides of the aisle. And, you know, I would disagree. I read the bill. Like, I try to approach things from a very agnostic, pragmatic, centrist sort of place. And I read it twice. And, you know, we were also told last weekend that it was going to gut the IRS. Well, page 53, line 11, there's a $1.4 billion cut to the IRS, does nothing to stop the hiring of those 87,000 IRS agents. Like, you know, don't sell me a bill of goods that isn't true. Be honest with the American people. Be truthful about it. And, you know, you hear folks go on today, again, not being fully transparent about what the bill does, repeating talking points that they were told that are not actually in the bill. Even CBO says there's not a $2 trillion deficit cut here. It's $1.5 trillion, and that's only if Congress promises to follow the caps from years 3 to 10, and there's nothing in here that says that Congress has to follow that after the second year.
The actual cuts and rescissions are much lower, right? The actual guaranteed cuts and rescissions much lower than your crossing your fingers and toes that in the out years, next Congress and beyond will continue to go along with it. We've seen in the past that's not the case. Yes, there's a cut to the IRS, which I'm in favor of. Does that mean they can't do any of this hiring ever? No, that's not true. I think that some of the negatives are being oversold, but some of the positives, supposedly, are also being oversold, which is sometimes how this whole game works. When it comes to leadership, and I just want to get your take on this, Congresswoman, we've seen some of your colleagues who are with you on this dead set against this bill and this deal, very angry with Speaker McCarthy. There are some rumblings about revisiting the leadership question and maybe a motion to vacate. I know that's been at least out there. Are you upset enough about the bill that you feel like Speaker McCarthy should possibly lose his job over this?
Well, motion to vacate, it's too premature to have that conversation right now. And I'm not part of the Freedom Caucus, and so I can't speak to what they negotiated as part of their deal to give Kevin their vote when he became speaker. So I'm not, I'm a caucus of one. I operate in a very independent manner. And so I don't know what they're doing or what they've negotiated or where they stand on different things. I can only do what I feel is the right thing to do for South Carolina and for the country. And I know that the vast majority of Americans are on our side. They want spending cuts in order to raise the debt ceiling. This bill doesn't do that. I'm for the American people. Always.
Congresswoman Nancy Mace, South Carolina, one, our guest on the Guy Benson Show. She's a no. Our next guest is a yes. We'll explain why with him, Congressman Dave Joyce, after the break. Congresswoman, thank you so much for your time, and we'll be right back after this.
New talk for a new generation. The Guy Benson Show.
Welcome back to the Guy Benson Show. So we just heard from an opponent of the debt ceiling bill. Let's now speak with someone who's in favor of it. Congressman Dave Joyce, Republican of Ohio, chairman of the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Homeland Security. Welcome back to the show, sir. Glad to have you.
Yeah, glad to be there again, Guy. Thank you very much.
All right, so just from a big picture perspective, what is your view on this deal? Obviously, you're a yes, but what got you to yes?
Well, the Fiscal Responsibility Act does what is responsible in that it's the things that are possible in a divided government, and it's required by our principles and promises. The debt limit agreement reduces overall spending, and it's paired with some solid policy reforms to streamline energy and infrastructure permitting and improve the functioning of government for the American people and provide a path forward for responsible government spending. And those folks who are committed to responsible governance here understand the balance of power in Washington, and they support the bill because, we're not a third world nation. The U.S. does not default on its debt.
So you were a yes on the Republican-passed House bill a couple of weeks ago that sort of shifted the ground and the terrain in Washington, D.C. The Democrats had a game plan of just blaming Republicans for doing nothing and not being able to govern. That all fell apart when you guys could govern and did govern and pass the only bill in town. A lot of your colleagues, at least a good number of them, a growing number of them over the last 2 days, who were in favor of that legislation said that was at least acceptable. This bill does not extract nearly enough concessions from the president. It doesn't really reduce spending in a meaningful way. Some of the quote-unquote victories aren't really victories. They're sort of on paper, but they're easily subverted by the administration and that sort of thing. What's your response to some of your colleagues, who you often agree with on most issues, saying, yes, a couple weeks ago, that was good enough, but this one just isn't?
Well, remember when we did that? We strengthened the speaker's position to actually begin these negotiations because the president, for 98 days, dragged his feet and wouldn't get engaged in any type of meaningful discussion with the speaker. Also, the fact that he's been a senator and vice president, now president, he understands the implications and the consequences of failing to raise the debt ceiling. And so he dragged it on, figuring that we're the gang who couldn't shoot straight and we'd never be able to pass the bill. And lo and behold, we were the only game in town. We gave it to the Senate. You want relief? There's the bill. Fix it. Send it back if you want to. Well, they didn't do anything. And then they finally went from a clean debt ceiling to negotiating with the speaker. And he put us in a position where we could do, we got some significant victories in this, but you have to look through it. You know, it limits, it reduces and limits our spending going forward. And, you know, we got to spur economic growth through things like reforms to NEPA and strengthening work requirements for SNAP and TAMP programs. And it accomplishes these savings without any new federal mandates or taxes. So many members on the fringes of both parties will continue to engage in political posturing, but members committed to responsible governance will support this agreement that makes good on our nation's promises and reins in the spending.
Do you actually believe that all of your Republican colleagues who are against this are just posturing, or do you think that they are in good faith opposed to this?
Well, certainly they have their reasons, you know, and it's easy to get to know. I mean, we were voting no on a regular basis when the Democrats were in the majority. It's harder to get to yes, and you have to sit down and realize that in any negotiation, there's give and take. And in this one, we went from clean debt ceiling to getting these things that we need. And I'm not saying that that this is not just posturing, but some of these people may vehemently disagree with one thing or another, and that's easy. When people have off-ramps, it's easy to say no and hope yes. But for those of us who understand how government works, let me just give you one quick example, Guy. The idea that, and I love this amendment from Thomas Massie, my friend, with the continuing resolution at 99% of last year's if we don't finish our appropriation bills. The appropriation bills are what not only set the regular order in motion, having those up and controlling spending, but this is the first time now we as a majority have the ability to put those bills in place and put the language in place. And for myself at Homeland Security, you ask for money for a border wall. Well, guess what? You either build a border wall or you don't spend the money. We get to put the in writing the handcuffs that are necessary to keep this government that has been going on with slush fund after slush fund and moving the money around once they receive it to whatever programs they want. We're tying their hands to make sure that they spend it on the things that they've asked for, and if not, they return it to the Treasury or be held accountable for the failure to spend it in the proper way. And that's important stuff. And as an appropriator, having top-line numbers that have already been agreed to by the Speaker and President early on is incredibly helpful. When we and understanding our limits as we draft the bills, and with the 1% automatic spending reduction associated with it, any CR puts in place strong incentives to help us return to this process, and it keeps us from having a shutdown again. The Democrats and majority cannot force a shutdown because we already have a CR in place.
You mentioned Thomas Massie from Kentucky, fiscally very conservative. He often votes no on many things. You know, sometimes you'll see a vote, it's like, you know, 432-1, and you're like, yeah, that might be Massie, and a lot of the times it is. For him to get to yes on this in committee with a crucial vote last night, that seems significant to me, right?
Absolutely. And Jim Jordan and Marjorie Taylor Greene. I mean, if you're honest about working within the system as it exists, not on what we wish would be happening here, but on it and how it exists now, and you want to make this government work, then you have to be part of it. And it's not all going to be your way, and it's not going to be pretty. But, you know, the country is, as you well know, center right or center left. It's not on either end of the spectrum. There are a lot of folks out there, and they're certainly vocal in their positions, but the majority of the country, they want to see lower gas prices. They want to see quality education for their kids, lower prices at the grocery store, and higher wages that actually purchase things without the cost of all those goods being inflated. And that's what having a government running lean and mean will get us a chance to do.
Let me ask you finally, one of my biggest frustrations about this is, like, I'm underwhelmed by the deal, but I was always going to be underwhelmed by the deal because there's a Democratic president, a Democratic Senate, and a Republican House barely. I mean, that's not exactly a recipe for something spectacular that I would like to see on the fiscal front. And part of that is because nearly the entire ballgame when it comes to the debt was off the table, according to both parties. The big entitlement programs, the long-term drivers of debt, not being touched, very little political will on either side to really tackle that, lots of pitfalls and attacks flying back and forth. That frustrates me.
Guy, you're exactly on point. I mean, when you put together all those mandatory spending parts of this, we took it all off the table as far as being able to achieve anything on those programs by passing Limit Save Grow. So all we're really talking about is 11% of the budget in which we're allowed to make these cuts.
Right.
And so when you do that, you handcuff yourself. And we are lying to the next generations who are counting on or paying in now to Social Security and Medicare because it's not going to be there for them. It's just not Medicaid. And those are all the drivers of the expenses. Those programs can be fixed, but it takes an honest intellectual discussion among both parties and the leadership in order to come to solutions. And one thing about Americans I appreciate is that they understand shared sacrifice, but we can't keep blaming the other side for not doing anything about it. It takes everybody working together to lay out what the problems are, what the potential solutions are, the cost of those solutions, and how we want to achieve.
I mean, look, I totally agree. Just color me skeptical about whether that is something that's going to happen anytime soon based on the way this town operates and the way our politics are right now. But that's, I guess, a discussion, obviously, for another day. Congressman Dave Joyce, Republican of Ohio, our guest on the Guy Benson Show. He's a supporter of this bill. Congressman, we appreciate your time. We'll talk soon.
Thank you very much, Guy. I appreciate it. And remember, I'm a Browns fan, so I think we're going to fix this one day.
Always optimistic. You have to be, or else you'll cry in Cleveland. Appreciate it. Coming up in the final hour of the Guy Benson Show, Chris Sununu, governor of New Hampshire. Is he running or not for president? We'll ask him that and more straight ahead.
Raise your glass to the Guy Benson Show Happy Hour. Brought to you by the Finnish Long Drink. Finland's most popular alcoholic beverage is taking America by storm. Visit thelongdrink.com. And now, here's Guy Benson.
It's the Happy Hour on the Guy Benson Show, our final hour of today's program. Thank you for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com is our website, at Guy Benson Show, Twitter and Instagram. You can follow us there on social. Check out our podcast, free on demand, every day when the show is over. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcasts.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. This hour, and really this summer, brought to you in part by the Finnish Long Drink. Our friends over there have a delicious product. They just rolled out their new peach flavor, which I am very eager to try. TheLongDrink.com is their website. You can find out where they're sold near you. I would start with the blue can or the white can, sort of the OG, and then branch out. TheLongDrink.com. Always drink responsibly. 21 plus only. Joining us now is Chris Sununu, the 82nd governor of the great state of New Hampshire. And, Governor, it's good to have you back on the show.
It is great to be here. There's only one real pressing question. I've never tried this, the long drink. What is this? Is this seltzer? Is it like a hard seltzer? Is it a beer?
I'm so glad that you asked, Governor, because they've been great sponsors of ours for a couple of years. I am a huge fan of it. It is closer to a seltzer, but it's better than the seltzer. So if you think about like a Truly or that kind of beverage, that is made with malt liquor, whereas the long drink is made with premium liquor. It's a Finnish creation in Finland. It's been the most popular alcoholic beverage in Finland for decades and decades. And my buddy started the company, brought it to the U.S., and it's just exploding in popularity. It's very refreshing. It's really good for late spring and summer in particular. I do enjoy it year-round, but like its peak season is summer. And it kind of tastes like a Fresca or a Squirt, but there's booze in it, but you don't really taste the booze, which is great, but also dangerous. So please drink responsibly.
A Fresca? How about a Fresca? I'm definitely going to try it. Look, for your listeners who don't know, New Hampshire is one of the few control states, which means I run one of the largest liquor retail outlets in the country. And so I will have to make sure that we get the long drink on our shelves. That sounds delicious. I will try one at 5:01 today.
Well, that's so like literally right now. So wait until the segment's over and then go find yourself a long drink. And if you're looking to see where it's near you, thelongdrink.com is their website. It sounds like you've got a few connections in that space, so I'll leave you to it. And then please do report back. And for the record, we did not plan this. This was not like an extra plugging of the sponsor. This is just curiosity from one of our great governors in the country. Governor, so let's just start with this. I have now seen you, two or three times in states other than New Hampshire, meeting with top Republican and conservative groups and donors and that sort of thing. Obviously, you've been testing the waters for a potential national run for president. You have not decided what you're going to do. I saw the other day you mentioned the next couple weeks will be your official decision, unveiled one way or the other. As you've been dipping your toe in the waters and listening to people, let's just start with that. What have you been hearing?
Well, everyone understands that the Republican Party ticket is vitally important. No one wants a repeat of 2022. Obviously, there's a lot of concern that if there's too many other candidates other than former President Trump on the ticket, that it's going to potentially dilute out the ability to galvanize behind a single candidate. I don't believe that. I think ultimately a lot of folks are going to get in. The discipline is getting out, right? Probably a little before Iowa and New Hampshire. If you're sitting in single digits or low single digits, move on out. Clear the field, but let's give everyone a chance to get on that debate stage who wants to have that chance. But then the discipline is kind of moving to a much narrower field, and I do believe that's going to happen. There's a lot of, you know, you need money. You know, when you have a great product, you got to advertise, and that takes really the financial support, and there is a lot of money out there, holy cow, that is not going with a former President Trump, that is very open to new ideas and new candidates, which is very exciting. And there's a path, and maybe not as traditional of a path for someone like myself, but boy, it is stark. It's right there. It's something that I'm encouraging everyone to look at, whether it's through Iowa or New Hampshire. There's a lot of, I don't want to call them disenfranchised Republicans, but Republicans that understand that Donald Trump is going to drag this ticket down, whether you support him or not. That's not the issue for me. It's thank you for your service, but you cost us Senate seats in 22. You cost us governorships. Your message does not sell to independents or young voters. We're constantly losing. That gap is getting bigger and bigger with those very key demographics. The suburban moms that are out there that we used to have in the party that we've lost, these are really critical folks we need back on the team, and he's not getting it done. So there's a lot of opportunity to bring those folks back, whether it's my message or someone else's. I think there's a lot of excitement around that. So people are optimistic, but right now, as we all know, the former president, I say it all the time, he's actually, of all people, Donald Trump is playing the victim card really well. I mean, he is. He's just, you know, and the media has created that. The left-wing media has really driven a narrative. This DA in New York is you know, just beating the heck out of him for purely political reasons. I empathize with that and sympathize with that. I think it's completely inappropriate. But, man, he is playing that one to its fullest extent. I just don't think, and I think a lot of people understand, it doesn't mean that support today doesn't necessarily translate to a vote 8 or 9 months from now. Still a long way out. We're still months away from the debates, for goodness sake. So a lot of game to play, a lot of opportunity in there.
Are you leaning one way or the other on this? Because you see all these guys and gals come through your state all the time. Nikki Haley's been setting up shop in New Hampshire a lot. Chris Christie reportedly getting in, and he's going to announce reportedly in New Hampshire a few days from now. Governor DeSantis is in Iowa, but he's going to be coming to New Hampshire very soon. So you very much have a front row seat as the governor of that state to a lot of the presidential politics. You see what's catching on with voters, what's not. That has to inform at least a little bit of a sway one way or another for you, doesn't it?
No, without a doubt. Look, I think one of the things that separates me apart from some of these other candidates, and they're all really good people. I mean, they're all friends of mine. They're all really, really good people, is that I did not start kind of down this path 6-7 months ago with the idea of, hey, I might think about running for president. That was not my mission at all. It's kind of evolved into that. I think people kind of, you know, I maybe speak a little differently. I'm a little more candid. I just have a different approach that's gotten some folks excited. And so, you know, folks have come to me and said, hey, you should really think about this. So I am. It's an honor that folks would look at New Hampshire. They see the model we've created here. It's terrific. I mean, our economy is just crushing it. We're the fastest growing state in the Northeast with the strongest economy, yada, 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 all these great statistics. So people see that model. They know it's a little different. They know I'm a little different. And so to kind of be fair to that process, I said, well, yeah, I'll absolutely explore this. But, you know, and I said I'd give it 6 months. I'd really give it 6 months to figure out what it's like to do this on the road. Is the money there? Is the path there? And all those things have really lined up. But I got to make sure I want to do it. I got to make sure it's, you know, I'm still a governor. I'm sitting in the governor's office right now. I'm still 24/7 on this job. So we're not going to do anything that puts New Hampshire at risk or anything like that because we've got this great model. And to your point, I do have a front row seat. And not just a front row seat to watch, but to really participate and make sure we're calling out candidates when they're being phony. We're calling out candidates when they're not being frank about things. We're calling out candidates that might be trying to get on a stage just so they'll be considered for a vice presidential seat. That drives me freaking crazy. I think those guys should be right off that stage. And just kind of calling that out. And maybe, in a way, my voice, is it better served in the party just kind of being kind of on the national media and kind of having that front row voice, or is it better served as a candidate on the stage? That's kind of what we're trying to figure out. What's the sacrifice? It's a huge sacrifice to do it. I mean, you got to make the commitment and say, look, I'm going to be gone from my family 179 out of the next 180 days, right? Because I'm not doing anything half-assed. I'm going to put 120% into it if we decide to go or no go. So it's a big decision for everyone, but the opportunity's there. And you know, if anything, that's really exciting.
We had you on this show multiple times while you were being courted, pressed, prodded to run for Senate in your state. And, of course, that was a seat that I thought was winnable, you thought was winnable. The nominee was not electable, ultimately, by the Republicans, and the Democrats held that seat. I think you would have won that seat had you thrown your hat into the ring. But you didn't want to be a senator. You made that very clear. You didn't want it. Your family didn't want it. This sounds different. Obviously, a chief executive is very different than being one of 100 in the Senate. But also the idea of moving to Washington and all of that, you seem to have very little taste for that not long ago. Different nature of a job, clearly, but does your family think differently about this? How are they feeling about this process over these last, what, 5.5 months?
Well, I'd say this. So, you know, we love our privacy. We're from New Hampshire. Everyone does. But there is a real path to get this country fixed. It is, and it's not broken per se. I think we just have a lot of ego in D.C. that gets in the way from getting stuff done. And at the end of the day, what's the point of getting elected if you're not getting stuff done? So they see the success we've had here. Everybody wants Washington to be different, to have a different attitude. I mean, the town has an attitude problem more than anything else, if you want to get to the heart of it. But good leadership can change that. And they've seen what we've been able to do in New Hampshire. They appreciate what it means for this country. And so in that respect, they're very supportive. And it's so different than being a senator. I mean, my goodness, as a governor or a president, you're on 24/7. The buck stops here. You got to make executive level decisions. It's so different than the House or the Senate, where maybe you get something done maybe once a week, or maybe you're just on vacation. I mean, really. I mean, everyone knows what a cynic I am of Washington in terms of the legislative process. But I also believe, and I've seen it here in New Hampshire, you know, good leadership. This is something that I think people forget. Good leadership can get stuff done no matter what hand they're dealt. You give me Democrats, I'm going to get a conservative agenda done. I've done it before. You give me Republicans, I'm not going to complain I didn't get the right Republicans. I can always get something done. So good leadership can always be effective no matter what the situation is. And that's exactly what this country needs, because we don't know the makeup of the House and Senate over the next 2 or 4 years. So you better bring in somebody that can get stuff done one way or the other. And there's a few of us out there, governors especially, but I think that's the opportunity that I think my family sees bringing, and the benefit it means not just for New Hampshire, but now really for the whole country. So that's exactly what we're looking at.
You made the point about a wide field or a wider field helping Trump, and the winnowing being important. And the point you made was, it's not about who gets in, it's about who gets out and when. Is that something, obviously, if you were going to get in, you wouldn't jump in planning to lose. You would get in because you think you had a path to win. If you or anyone else, let's put it that way, is in the race, doing everything they can to the best of his or her ability, but there's just no traction, are you saying that you, or are you counseling others, at that point, that would be the moment to get out? I just want to tease out your thoughts on that a bit more.
Absolutely. And not only am I telling that to other candidates, and I've said it to them all, I'm telling that to their donors. A lot of folks will stay in a political race longer than they should because, you know, donors have, you know, they've raised millions of dollars and they feel obligated to the donors. But the donor class has to stand up and say, hey, I supported you. You're just causing problems now. It's not working. You got to get out. And so everybody on the team, I get it. The last people that will tell you to get out are your own staff, right? You're the political consultants that make all this money and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So the
right.
discipline is really from the candidates, from a lot of the bigger donors to say, yeah, we support you, but it's not happening. And for the good of this country, for the good of the party, really, we got to clear the field. We gave it our best shot. There can only be one winner. So let's figuring that out sooner than later is critically important. And you know, one of the things I think of is, can I be more effective on the stage doing that, or kind of outside the stage, outside the field? And that's something that we're weighing. But it's going to be a critically important issue that we talked about in 16, but no one committed to. It has to happen in 24.
One more 24-related question for you. Then I've got a couple other news of the day items. you're probably at least paying some attention to this battle happening right now between the people who are in first and second place in the party, at least right now. Donald Trump, way ahead in the polls. He's the front runner. And then in second place is Governor DeSantis from Florida, who's now really hitting the campaign trail hard, having just announced last week. Trump, who's throwing everything but the kitchen sink at DeSantis and has been for months, he is really sticking with this line that New York and Andrew Cuomo handled COVID better than Florida and DeSantis. He's doubling and tripling down on that. DeSantis now firing back. Andrew Cuomo coming in and praising Trump, saying he's right. New York was better. This blue state lockdown model was better and more responsible. I know you're not in either of those camps, but there are some broader sort of policy issues at play in that dispute. What do you make of it?
It's bullshit. Oh, sorry. Am I not allowed to say that?
But, we'll bleep it.
Yeah, sorry. No, that alone should tell you what you're getting with Donald Trump. Donald Trump is siding with, of all people, Andrew Cuomo for his own – for this bizarre political attempt to, you know, discredit Governor DeSantis. And so it's – I mean, let's just take a step back from that and go, what are we doing? That's the guy leading the Republican ticket, the guy who's praising Andrew Cuomo after completely throwing him under the bus. I think New York handled the COVID pandemic terribly, horribly. And that's not just an outsider's opinion. That's as a fellow governor that was on the phone with Cuomo and every other governor and the president and vice president almost every day for a while. You know, trying to – but there are states that handled it well and states that didn't. Florida did a great job. New Hampshire did a great job. Texas did well. I mean, a lot of states handled it really, really well. And to say – to try to put New York above that is just simply nonsense. I mean – and it's really a discredit and a disservice to all the other red states that really handled this the right way, Florida being one of them, of course. And it says a lot about Donald Trump. And that's what folks have to take home. This Donald Trump is not about the Republican Party. He's not about a strong ticket. He's not about that R. He's about the D in Donald. That's what comes first with him. And now he's put Andrew Cuomo over other Republican interests. That's telling. That's absolutely telling to me.
All right, shifting gears with Governor Chris Sununu to a couple different topics as soon as we come back on The Guy Benson Show.
In the swamp, not of the swamp. Guy Benson.
New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu still with us here on The Guy Benson Show Happy Hour. All right, two more things very quickly. Number one, the debt ceiling fight in D.C. I'm sure is the epitome of stuff that you hate about Washington. One of the reasons you're probably glad you're not a U.S. senator, although I would much rather have you than Maggie Hassan. Different question, water under the bridge. What do you say to people who look at that and say, well, 2 seconds ago, Governor Sununu said Washington isn't broken. This really looks like Washington is broken. How would you handle that type of issue, let's say, if you were president, differently than what we've seen now for years and years under presidents of both parties?
Well, a deal's getting done. So I give Kevin McCarthy, a heck of a lot of credit. He made the first move. It was a strong move. He got Biden to capitulate and give in. I love this gas line stuff that they're getting. So maybe it's not all the economic benefits and the spending cuts a lot of us would like to see. But we're not going to get everything we want to see, guys. I mean, we don't control the Senate, right? We don't have the presidency. We're not going to get everything we want. But he got something, and I give him credit. I think Tom Massey is doing a great job. He's holding the line, making sure that there's a path to get this done. There are a lot of folks behind the scenes really, making it work. But if anyone's like, boy, we didn't get all the spending cuts we wanted, that would have been beyond a miracle. Like, that just wasn't going to happen. But we got something, and they had to capitulate on something. So a deal had to be made for the greater good of the country. I think it's a sign that things aren't broken. Look, the founding fathers designed the system so that getting anything done in Washington was really hard, right? That's pure checks and balances. And that's different than almost anywhere else in the world, by the way. Right, we have a bicameral legislature. Do people realize that's a very rare thing on the planet? We don't have a prime minister elected by the legislature. We have an independent executive. That's a very rare thing in the planet, and very strategically designed so the federal government had to really, really work hard to come together to get stuff done. It gets me frustrated.
Oh, yeah. No,
of
it's
course.
It's some gridlock by design. That's absolutely true, and that's an important counterpoint in this whole conversation. I wanted to ask you about your appearance recently on The View, which is a real line. Lion's Den for conservatives. We're out of time. In one word, Governor, how was your time on The View?
successful, a pathway for other Republicans to be successful. I showed the path. I hope everyone goes on and wins the debate, wins the argument.
Yeah, find the YouTube clip and watch it, I guess, is the idea there. Governor Chris Sununu of New Hampshire, a Republican, our guest on The Guy Benson Show. Governor, we so appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
All right, thanks, brother. Be good.
We'll be right back after this.
America is listening to The Guy Benson Show.
It's the happy hour. It's The Guy Benson Show on this Wednesday. Thank you very much for tuning in. Earlier in our last hour, we welcomed back to the program, but for the first time as a presidential candidate, Nikki Haley, former South Carolina governor, former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. We had a wide-ranging discussion. Here's part of it. What is your reaction, and if you were president, how would you have handled this situation?
I mean, it's a bipartisan national disgrace. I mean, you know, it's easy to blame Biden, but we need to speak truth here. Our Republicans did this to us, too. You know, this all started, you go back to that $2.2 trillion COVID stimulus bill that basically expanded welfare that now leaves us with 90 million Americans on Medicaid, 42 million Americans on food stamps. And if that wasn't enough, Republicans doubled down and opened up earmarks for the first time in 10 years. You know, pushing through 7,000 of them in December, 7.5 million on horse racing in Arizona, 30 million on Honors College in Vermont, 10 million on a courthouse in Colorado. And so now we get to the situation where they're talking about the debt ceiling. And here you go again. They basically take off from after a post-COVID like flush of money and don't even take that into account. I mean, they're focusing on increasing the debt by another $4 trillion over the next 2 years. It doesn't actually cut spending after all of this pandemic spending that we've had. It just kicks the can down the road. And that's why you see all the major conservative groups oppose it. It's a serious problem that we have with Congress. They can't say that Republicans and Democrats don't agree on anything because they love to waste taxpayer dollars. And they're showing that once again.
What do you think Speaker McCarthy should have done differently in this particular fight? I mean, I think broadly speaking, a lot of things need to change in Congress and in D.C. And the fact that they took some of the biggest drivers of debt, the biggest drivers of the debt, off the table entirely on a bipartisan basis. I mean, I get why they did that for political reasons, but for actual fiscal reasons, it is just maddening to me. Within this context, the Democrats holding the Senate, Joe Biden in the White House, do you think McCarthy could have driven a better bargain here, a tougher bargain here?
I mean, look, a House majority means something. I mean, it means that we actually have the ability to push where things go. And I think we needed two things. We needed a plan to cut spending, and we needed a plan on how we're going to start to pay down the debt. And we didn't get that. All this did was literally kick the can down the road for somebody else to deal with at another time. And we need to be honest with the American people. We need to go and say this flush of cash that happened during the pandemic was dangerous. It was not good. We saw that. We need to start dealing with it. I mean, you go back, and I've said, look back at 2018. They did this at that time. They went and they passed through all of this increased spending, and it wasn't helpful. And you look at that and you say, you know, they supported raising the debt by trillions of dollars 5 years ago, and look at where we are now. Now they're going to turn around and do it again with $4 more trillion. And I can tell you, our kids are never going to forgive us for this.
Nikki Haley, you announced your presidential campaign in mid-February. We are now almost in June. You've been campaigning hard. You've been in your home state of South Carolina. I've seen you all over the place, Iowa, New Hampshire, all of those early states, obviously. As you're out there on the trail, what are some of the biggest themes that you are hearing from voters? And what impact has that had, those messages, what have they had on this campaign that you're running?
I think that, you know, the biggest message that I hear across the three states is just the economy, the inflation, the spending, and the debt. I mean, people really feel that. They feel it going to the grocery store. They feel it, you know, whether they're going into credit card debt. They get the fact that this is not going anywhere anytime soon. And so that's a big thing. The second thing I hear about is transparency in the classroom. Parents are very worried that they don't know what's being said to their kids. They don't know what's being taught to their kids, and they deserve to know. And then immigration, illegal immigration. I mean, what's happening on the border has really upset a lot of people because now every state's a border state. And they feel it, whether it's the fentanyl that's coming you know, into their states, or whether it's just the fact that all of these illegal immigrants have crossed over, and that's a further burden on our economy.
I want to talk about this actually coming up a little bit later on the show. I have a couple thoughts. We've got the sound bites, but just boiling it down, we have not really seen any campaigning at all from the sitting president. He announced that he's running again. He wants another 4 years. They put out a video. That's it. I mean, no events. They're not telling us about the numbers that they're getting in terms of small donors online, anything like that. What do you make of that? Are you surprised to see virtually nothing at all from the reelection campaign of this president?
I'm not surprised at all. I mean, this is a man who won by campaigning in his basement. And mm-hmm. so now he's going to release a video. We're not going to see much. And this is why I will continue to say a vote for Biden is truly a vote for President Harris. We have to understand that if Biden wins, it is really President Kamala Harris that we're looking at. And America needs to wake up. We have a country to save. We've got to make sure we get on the right track. We need a new generational leader. We need someone that's going to deal with these new issues with new solutions. And we've got to get us back on track. Americans are tired. They're just tired. They're tired of the spending. They're tired of the rhetoric. They're tired of the negativity. They're tired of, you know, all of this political correctness.
My full interview with Nikki Haley, available online at GuyBensonShow.com. Also available on our podcast, the whole show, every day for free on demand when the show is over. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcasts.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we come back, the home stretch, producer Christine has a new scheme. I'm not sure this is one of her better ideas, which is saying something. We'll delve into that as soon as we return.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.
Home stretch on this Wednesday. Guy Benson Show. Heading to the train, heading up to New York when this show is over today. All sorts of TV in the days to come. Kudlow, Gutfeld, America's Newsroom, The Big Show on weekends, Outnumbered, and more. So stay tuned for all of that with programming notes. Our radio show is very simple, though. 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern, and then the podcast is free, GuyBensonShow.com, every day. All right, so Christine casually mentioned something on the planning call today, and she also casually mentioned that this is something that her husband, Bobby, does not yet know about. It's just a little thing, Bobby, if you're listening, because you often do. Don't worry about it. It's just a very small, insignificant decision that Christine has cooking for you and your family. Christine, what do you have planned?
I'm meeting with a real estate agent, and I think I'm going to buy a house.
Okay, so for those people who might be newer to the program, would you care to share your recent decisions on this front? You have been living in an apartment for how long now?
A year and a month.
Okay, so a year, basically. You sold your house. You were a homeowner. You and Bobby owned a home.
Uh-huh.
You sold the home. You moved into an apartment. You were very excited about the apartment. Do I have this right so far?
Mm-hmm.
And then what? You're already tired of apartment living? You want out?
I want out. I had enough. And let's remind the audience, when I decided to sell the home, I announced it here before. Actually, I think I even had a realtor come to the home before Bobby knew about it. Remember?
Yeah, he, I think, found out about this plan that you had to sell the house because he listens to the show.
Yes.
It didn't come up at the dinner table at the house. It came up on the home stretch on this show. So he was probably like on a bus somewhere with AirPods in.
He was sitting on the bus. And all of a sudden he heard from great old Guy Benson that a realtor was coming. And I was thinking about putting the house on the market. But let me just add, because everybody thought I was crazy. It worked out. It worked out very well for everybody.
Well, in the sense that you got a good price for your house.
Yep.
The market was pretty hot at the time, so you were pleased with the price point. And the apartment that you were moving into, you were sort of raving about the amenities and the pool and all of that. So before we get into what you're now hoping or planning to do, why are you done with apartment living? Is it just too cramped? Are some of the concerns that I raised about shifting from a home to an apartment, are those coming true in your life, Christine? Was I perhaps right about some of those things?
I will not say that you were right on air.
Yeah.
But maybe off air, I would say.
Off air, yeah.
You were kind of right.
I often am.
I think that the fun of it kind of wore off. It seemed more like a hotel to us, and we were coming and going. And then you realized, like, these amenities are great, but you are sharing them with a lot of people, and you don't have say over certain things, and it just, it's not as great as we once thought. Also, can I say, apartment quality, like, you know, like kitchens and all that stuff, like it's not the best. Even though it looks pretty and shiny and new and nice, it might not be the best quality.
Yeah, the fixtures are going to be often a little bit lower quality.
Yeah, and a lot of things are just like breaking, and it takes, you know, I mean, it's nice that you can call a super, but like it's taking a while for those things to get fixed. I think Rosie's a little depressed. That's my dog. She doesn't really have a backyard. Mm-hmm. I miss actually having a backyard to entertain.
I'm having deja vu because every point that you're making, I think, were among the points that I raised when I was warning. I was not saying that you shouldn't sell your house. I was just saying you've got to be careful and think through some of this. And it wasn't just for the immediate future. It was also until the housing market was in a much better place where it would make sense for you to then jump back in. And this is where I'm getting worried about whatever this new scheme is, because you do produce this show. So you probably occasionally, at least by accident, hear something about interest rates, right? And the Fed with inflation and all of that. You are aware that buying a house right now with the interest rates where they are, it is extra, extra painful to try to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I can go back and listen, but I'm pretty sure he did.
Point by point?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, a lot of these are coming up, and I'm remembering these conversations because it wasn't that long ago, Christine. It was like most a year and a half ago that you started to go through all of this. And I was like, all right, well, just be careful. It's like talking to a teenager who's about to make an impulsive decision that isn't catastrophic but needs to be thought through. But, you know, you just become this freight train where you decide something and then you go no matter what. And just my argument here is it the best time to be trying to buy a home right now? Was this whole rigmarole of selling the house, moving to the apartment, etc., would it be worth it if you then get saddled with a really high interest rate on a loan for the house, number one? Number two, do you have a house in mind? Is there a specific home that you are looking at?
Yes.
That you're there is.
Yes.
Okay. And yes. Why do you like this home?
It's brand new. It's being built right now. So it's one of those, and like a real, I'm not going to say the neighborhood, but a very, very nice neighborhood in North Jersey.
So a nice town?
Good
town?
Yeah. Very nice town.
Okay. It's being built. Do you know what it looks like? Are there sketches and
renderings? Yeah, the real estate agent is going in and like just showing me videos that, you know, what they're doing. I think they're putting trim in the kitchen right now.
This isn't even on Zillow.
Like, no, it's not
so
on the market.
So how did you find out about this?
I know a person. She seemed to like me. I go to open houses a lot with Megan. Sometimes we like to do that on Sundays. Just go look at real estate. Megan's very...
So you got a tip from one of your realtor friends.
So I always meet realtor people. And one time me and her, I was at this open house for like an hour just chatting with her. So sometimes she'll just send me some things. And she had a tip today. It's like horse racing.
Today? You found out about this today?
Horse racing, by the way. Just got this tip this morning.
And you're already planning what? You can't visit it. You can't see anything, right?
I mean, the house is built. They're just now working on the inside. It's one of those. It was in a neighborhood, and then they tore it down, and then they redid it. Like a construction company came in.
Is
it's just
big?
Like a one-off. It's four bedrooms.
Okay.
It's
is
three
it bigger than your old house?
No. No.
Smaller than your old house?
I would say maybe the same size, but everything is brand new. Like,
so nicer, newer, nicer neighborhood and town?
Yeah, the neighborhood. Okay, so here's what my question to you. And also, guess what? The construction people said that I could pick all my own paint colors. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, okay, this is like very tiny minutia.
Really?
Compared to the big questions here.
Oh, okay.
Is it still close to where Megan goes to school, or would she have to change schools?
Well, don't forget, she goes to private school.
I know, but...
No, she would not have to change schools. No, it's like 5 minutes away. It's closer to her school, to her gymnastics, to her sporting events.
Do you know what the asking price is going
to be? I do. And they told me, listen to this. If I get in now, they won't even put it on the market. It's because you know how like there's bidding wars. Like the price is as is because her aunt is the lister. So she's going to talk to her aunt. Aunt?
Either one.
Mm-hmm.
So is this a house that you can comfortably afford right now, setting aside the very high interest rates?
No. No, we cannot.
Okay.
This is my next question. I have two questions for you. How bad would it be to hit up Judgy Joyce for some dough?
Oh, boy. So I believe the plan that was discussed all along was you would only jump back into the housing market to buy a home when it was the dream house that was also big enough for Judgy Joyce to come and move in with you guys.
Right,
that was the plan. Mm-hmm. Does this house fit that bill?
No. Judgy Joyce has multiple times told me, and she said, get it through your head, Chris. I'm not living with you.
I mean, wise woman, but you are now going to try to come to her and say, I want money for this house that I cannot afford, that also cannot accommodate you, should you have a change of heart. That's a bit of a tough sell, but... Even with, like, if you took out a mortgage, you just know the finances with you and Bobby do not work on this house.
I know. They do. Listen, to be honest, they do work. We can make it happen. See, the thing is...
You'd be really extending yourself, though?
Well, the thing is, Bobby, we'll do this whole rigmarole of talking about this, and Bobby goes, here's where you need to cut. Yes, yes, yes. Here's where, you know, like we had said a couple months ago, let's just not get a new car. Let's not have a car payment for a while. Well, that probably should have happened now, thinking... forward. I think you recommended
But you did it
getting,
anyway.
You recommended getting a new car, didn't you?
You got your Buick.
Yeah,
I did not recommend getting a new car.
I thought you did.
No. You get new cars every year. I think the whole plan is not a good one.
I think that was me that recommended. Maybe.
Someone told me to get a new car, and I did, and I love it.
Christine, would I ever be like, oh yeah, your car's a year old. Go get a new one. Does that sound like advice I might give you?
No.
Ever?
No.
No. So that was not my plan either. All right. I feel like this conversation is just getting started. And now Bobby knows because he's probably listening. Hi, Bobby. Right now. Enjoy. New house. Can't afford it. Good luck. And maybe we'll have a follow-up tomorrow or the next day or like see how much a divorce lawyer costs in the scheme of things. I mean, that's all coming on The Guy Benson Show. We'll bring you details as they emerge. In the meantime, heading to New York, lots of TV coming up. Same time, same place here on the radio tomorrow. Have a great night. Thank you for listening.
Hi, this is Dave Anthony. Saturday marks 25 years since the Columbine School Massacre. We talked to a survivor, Craig Scott, who lost his sister but saved some classmates that day. We invite you to listen to the whole interview in our Rundown Extra, Saturday at foxnewspodcast.com.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.